Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome. This is our very, very first broadcast for the sex work and sexualities section of New Book Network. My name is Rachel Stewart. I'm a PhD student at the University of Kent, and my area of interest is webcamming as a form of sexual commerce. And I've invited along Dr. Kate Lister to talk about her awesome book, The History of Sex. So Kate, tell us about the book. Tell us about, you know, what prompted you to write the book. And if you could tell the listeners about your awesome project, The Halls of Yore, which I'm a huge fan of.
Oh, Rachel, you're so lovely. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk. I'm so excited about this. Where do you even start? All right, we'll start at the beginning. Okay, so A Curious History of Sex. It's not my first book, but the other books I've written have been academic books, and no one ever cares about them. like Victorian paraphernalia and just stuff like that. But so this is my first book that I've written that, do you know, I really wanted to write it, and I wanted to write it in my own style, and I wanted to write it as if I'm just chatting to the reader. And one of the things that has always fascinated me about sex, which I find infinitely fascinating for many reasons, but the history of it in particular, is how similar we still are and yet how vastly different, and just how attitudes and scripts change all the time, and just how funny it can be, as well as harrowing and awful and all of those things that can be at the same time. And I wanted to try and put that into a book to sort of flag up some of the curious things that people have done throughout history and done to each other and to themselves and to other people, all in the pursuit of an orgasm, I suppose. So it's me looking at history. It's a really wide span, looking at right back into the ancient world and kind of more contemporary stuff, but it's largely areas of history that have caught my interest and my attention, and things that I have found fascinating and curious about it. So I cover everything from sex work in the ancient world through to testicular monkey transplants in the 20th century and kind of everything in between. So yeah, and it's, you know, I suppose I kind of always envisioned that I might write another one, because you couldn't possibly write a definitive history of sex, could you? You just go on and on and on, so there's definitely more to be said. But yeah, so it's things that have interested me, and the history of sex work has endlessly fascinated me, so it was very important to do that. And one of the nice things about the book was I was able to use it to raise some money for Basis, a charity in Leeds who support sex workers and have done for 30 years. So the book itself was published with a group called Unbound, who use a slightly different model. They use a crowdfunded model to raise the funds. So everyone kind of pre-orders, but like years in advance. But whatever you make above the amount needed to publish the thing, you get to keep. So I was able to give mine to Basis. So I raised them $5,000. So I was really pleased with that. I was like, yay. So it felt like not only did I manage to, you know, write a book that I'm really proud of, but also it can do a bit of good in the world as well. And I was really wanted it to do that.
Excellent, excellent. You know what? It was really funny because the first time I opened the book, I opened the book to a page with a big picture of an oyster. Yeah. And I almost felt like I was going to serve you some sort of copyright issue because it looked like my own genitalia, like literally, it was like looking at my baby. Yeah.
I love that.
And it instantly clarified something for me. It instantly clarified, A, why the oyster would be an aphrodisiac. I couldn't quite get my head around that before. I just thought it was because it was like slimy. But it also made me think about how, you know, how sex has been reduced in this time period, how we've reduced it to a kind of like, you know, the physical act rather than just looking at all the other stuff around it. And what I was really interested in when I was reading your book is your use of language. And I wondered what had got you started thinking about the terms that we use for this different, you know, genitalia for the different sex acts.
Yeah, so like one of the things that I've done in the book is I've tried to put in as many examples of historical slang as I possibly can. Excuse me. Partly because it makes me laugh, you know, like reading through historical, what were people calling genitals and sex and blowjobs 200 years ago? But also because I think that language is such an important part of how we understand the world. You know, it doesn't just record the world, it creates the world. And when you look at how language has evolved, you can trace cultural attitudes around it. For example, if we take the word cunt, so I'm just going to drop the C-bomb right there. Back when we can trace it to, like, its earliest uses, it wasn't an offensive word. You know, it turns up in medical texts. It turns up in, it was just, cunt was cunt. It was just a normal, I mean, it's got slightly bawdy connotations, as cunts tend to do. But when you trace it, it starts to become really offensive, be regarded as obscene, about the time of Puritan control, and when sexuality itself starts to become repressed, the sort of the later Middle Ages, it starts taking on new connotations. And then as that gets going and as attitudes change and shift, it suddenly becomes the most offensive word in the English language. One of them, right? But that's always blown my mind as well. It's just like, how could a word that just means vulva possibly be that offensive? You know, and like the power dynamics that's implicit in that, that we don't really question. We go, well, you know, just don't say cunt to your boss and it'll be fine. But, it depends who your boss is, I suppose. But we don't stop to think, but what is that saying? Is that saying that cunts are the most offensive thing in the English language? Which is an odd thing to say, isn't it? Like, that's like, the shame around sex and sexuality and genitals is absolutely embedded in our language and how we understand the world.
But it's quite odd, isn't it? If you think about it, I mean, you know, the cunt, like the vulva, is where life starts.
Like, right, absolutely.
You don't have life without a cunt.
No.
Why would that be so offensive? But what I really liked about what I sort of saw in your book as well is the origin of the word cunt and cunning.
Because
my cunt has been very cunning at times. almost to the point it's got a life of its own. And I just was really taken by your use of language. And for anyone who doesn't know you, Kate does an awesome Twitter account called The Whores of Yore, where she, you know, she lists like words for different anatomical bits of the human body, different actions. So, you know, Whores of Yore on Twitter, go and find it and you'll have fun there. But I was really struck as well about the name that you use for Whores of Yore. So before we talk about the name, can you tell me a bit about the Whores of Yore?
Yes. So it's I'd love to tell you that it was a really well thought out and well plotted research plan and strategy, but it wasn't at all. Like a lot of the things that I think are best in the world, it was kind of a serendipitous thing that happened. It was just, and I absolutely love it now and I enjoy it. But it came about because I was researching medieval sex workers one day, as you do, and I came across the name of a woman who'd been arrested in London in the 14th century, and the name that she'd given to the authorities was Clarice Clatterbollocks, and I just I just fell about laughing because I'm like, not only is it really funny, but it was obviously supposed to be funny. It was supposed to be funny. And like, and I suddenly realized that, like, not only is the joke still funny 600 odd years later, but sex workers still use aliases. They still have kind of, you know, porn star names and stripper names, and all these things. And then just look how similar that is. And so I was absolutely fascinated by that, and I loved it. And I thought, I'm going to tweet some of this stuff because I just find the most random, fantastic stuff. And I was messing about on Twitter because I should have been doing work. And then I started a Twitter account because I went, oh, whore rhymes with your. Look at me, I'm so funny. Like an absolute tit. And then I started it not thinking anything of it at all. And people just started, I guess people also agree with me that Clarice Clatterbollocks is really fucking funny. And then, you know, and then I started tweeting more stuff, and then other people started sending me stuff, and then it grew and grew, and now this is kind of, this is what I do. It's my baby. And yeah, that's where it came from. So it sort of took on a life of its own. Yeah. Yeah.
I noticed that you said that you probably shouldn't have used the phrase whores of yore. And I was quite surprised that sex workers had said that they didn't like that, because I've not always been as mainstream as I am nowadays, okay? And that's all I'm going to say on air. But, you know, I have a certain entitlement to the phrase whore, and I actually really like it, and I like it a lot more than sex worker, because worker implies labourer, and I was definitely not a labourer. I was far more professional than a labourer. And a lot of what I would do was less work than it was hustle, or less work than it was like intuitively knowing what somebody wants, yeah?
Yeah.
And so I think sex work implies as a physical labour that I don't think necessarily belongs in the realm of sex work. Like, don't get me wrong, yeah, there is a certain amount of labour involved, but I don't think sex work really covers it well enough. And I think whore does. I like the word whore.
I love the word whore. But that's one of the interesting things about the way language works, though, isn't it? Is words so rarely have one meaning. And even if you think you know what it means, it doesn't mean that to somebody else.
Yeah.
So to me, the word whore, I like it too. I like it because it feels it has a slightly archaic thing like harlot and strumpet. I kind of like that bit about it. But also it's got that slightly like naughty, like, yeah, I am a massive whore. And it's kind of like a reclamation thing. But that is a very different perspective from somebody who has been called a whore by an arresting police officer, or who's had that word used against them, not as a kind of a state of reclamation, but as an insult. So I've had that fed back to me by people that I shouldn't use it, that I don't have a right to use it. And I understand that. And it's interesting as well, because I've done sex work, you know, not like full time or anything like that, but it's kind of interesting of like, well, and who gets to use it? Is it okay that I use it because I have done sex work in the past, or do I have to have done a certain amount of sex work to be allowed to use it? And it's like, you know, like, what are these rules? And we're constantly renegotiating them all the time. But I think as well, the word doesn't just apply to people that sell sex. I think that, unfortunately, most women have been called a whore at some point.
Totally.
And you don't have to be selling sex in order to have been called a whore. It's like slag, isn't it? Oh, you're slag or you're slut. It's just the go-to random weird way that you would attack a woman. And I thought that was really important as well. Like, why is that the insult? Yeah. And it doesn't matter. Like Joan of Arc, who died a virgin, famously, that was her big thing. That was her brand. I am a virgin. And what did the English do? We went, whore. What? That's just so lazy. What did we get? Is that the best that we could have come up with? Slag. It just, do you know what I mean? So I thought that's what it symbolizes as well, doesn't it? Is whenever a woman gets too full of herself or too powerful or needs taking down a peg or two, that's it. That's where you go. Yeah. You attack of sexuality.
But it's quite funny, isn't it, as well? It tells us a lot about how we consider like the female genitalia.
Yes.
So you could be as smart as you want. I mean, there are several people walking around on this planet with scars who have chosen the word whore in the wrong context when talking to me. Yeah, because actually when you know, it's a reduction, isn't it? It's a reduction to your genitalia.
Yes.
A genitalia that, despite being life-giving, has been used as a kind of reductive.
Yep. Yep. You know? See, that's the thing, is it's like, you could call yourself whore, or like your mates could, and you know exactly how you're using it, and you know exactly the parameters it's being used in. But if somebody else does it, and they don't have permission, and they don't have the right to do that, then they're going down, basically.
Yeah.
And it's that, the power of the word is enormous. You know, I still get messages from people over Twitter occasionally asking me to change the name. It's kind of weird. Like I had a guy the other day message me, and he just said, could you change the name, please? We've all got mothers and grandmas. I don't know who he thought I was. I emailed him back to just be like, what? I'm a woman. And then it was weird. But yeah.
I think it's quite funny, because in the time in the past of that, word's been used against me, and you can see by the way somebody's face is after the delivery, it's like there you've got the bomb, and it's like, sorry, are you making a point?
Yeah. Yes. And it's such a strange word, because it only has power if you let it have power, I suppose. One of my favorite people on Twitter is Stormy Daniels. I absolutely adore watching her, and what I love most about her is not just how funny she is, but how like these trolls that try to attack her have got nowhere to go with her, because all they've got is like, they say, you fucking slag, and then she'll tweet back and just be like, yeah, sounds about right. And she's, do you know what I mean? Or like there's one, like they'll call her like a dumb whore, and then she'll just tweet back, it's just like, I am not dumb. And that's it's like they've got nothing, because she absolutely inhabits that. She doesn't give a fuck. And it's just really surreal watching the dynamics of like, if you don't let it puncture you, where do they go?
Yeah.
You know, they've got nothing. They've got nothing more to offer. Yeah. She's had a lot of sex. She does not give a fuck. And it's just, and I just love that. It's interesting to see it, is if you don't let it shame you like that. But then then, you know, it's very hard to, do you even have that choice to choose not to be shamed? I don't know.
I mean, when you were sort of researching the book, at what point does sort of sex become transactional, and then comes from going from being transactional to being frowned upon? Because I remember reading a book about sex in the Babylonian era, and sex in the Babylonian era was okay as long as you were already outside the patriarchy. So if you were a widow and you haven't got anyone to look after you, it's fine. But if you're married or you've got some money to pass on, because that's how wealth is generated down through the generations. So, you know, if you're doing your thing and accidentally conceive some random baby, it might inherit somebody else's wealth it shouldn't get. So then prostitution becomes an issue if you're within the patriarchal sort of framework. But if you're outside, it's all good. Yeah. So yeah. I wondered how far back we go when sort of transactional sex starts to be an issue.
So the earliest records that have been discovered about transactional sex, it's ancient Babylonia. I think it's either 3 or 5,000 BC. I've got a scrambled brain, I can't quite remember. And it's actually a record of inheritance rights if a sex worker becomes pregnant. Mm. So that is some of the earliest records, which highlights exactly what you're talking about, which is not only property rights and patriarchy, but exactly what do you do with these people, primarily women who exist outside your nice little get married, have babies idea.
Yeah.
So I think that's the earliest record that we have got of it. So it has always been with us, but attitudes to sex and sex work shift vastly throughout different cultures. There is some evidence that you could have sacred prostitution in Babylonia and ancient Mesopotamia. And I say ever because it's fiercely contested, because all we've got is just fragments and hints and little bits and pieces and a myth, a foundational myth in the Epic of Gilgamesh of a sex worker called Shamhat, who manages to civilize the wild man. But she's definitely whoring. That's her whole thing. She's a priestess and she is paid to have sex with people. But how much you extrapolate from that is tricky. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that they actually existed? But what you can tell is this foundational myth of ancient Babylonia is she wasn't regarded as shameful. Not at all. She was regarded as very powerful, as somebody that could civilize man through her sexual skills. So that isn't someone that's shamed at all.
No.
So I go on.
That implies a kind of an appreciation of your skill set.
Yeah, it does.
If everyone's having sex, but you're being paid to have sex,
that
implies a recognition of your sexuality, doesn't it?
It does. And she was incredibly skilled. She's described as a priestess, but she's also a harlot, a temple harlot. So that's, and she was very respected, very powerful, and has sex with gods and kings for money.
Yeah.
You know?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think it's quite interesting the discussions that we don't have around sort of patriarchal systems and the perceptions around sex work, because it's really interesting when you see changes in patriarchal systems and the discussion around sex work changes.
Absolutely. I think the two most formative power structures around sex work are A, patriarchy, and B, capitalism. They're the two things. And I know that like some people think that if you got rid of capitalism, you get rid of sex work. No, I don't think that you would. I think it would look very different. I think it would look very different. I don't think you'd get rid of it. But all throughout history, patriarchy has massively disadvantaged women, hugely. And capitalism, we've all got to make a living somehow. We're all selling something. And throughout Western history, if you're a woman, how the hell do you get your money? How the hell? When especially if you're a kind of, where'd you work? Like you could go and there were some jobs that have been open to women, but they paid pittance. It wasn't enough to live on. It was absolute pittance. You needed a man. You needed your father to support you through his family, or you needed a husband, and you needed one damn quick because they made the money and they would support you. The other option, of course, is if you want to work on your own, you sell sex.
Yeah.
That, and it has been throughout history, that has been a means of primarily women earning a lot of money. How else do women get money? You know, they can inherit it, or they can marry it, or they can shag it. Those are like your sort of your major three options. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose ideally you'd be a widow. You'd marry someone really rich. He'd die. And then you'd go, woohoo, I am off. But even that is dependent on a sexual labor. That's throughout history. That's been it.
Yeah.
And sex work has been dominated by women. And it still today continues. The reason people turn to it is because you can make a lot of money in a very short space of time.
Yeah. It's quite funny. I was reading a book. I can't remember who it was by. I want to say Sanchez, but it talked about the registration of prostitutes in the Roman Empire. And one of the reasons was to discourage rich women from selling sex because it was independent wealth. I think another thing as well, and I'm going to sort of like move this on from this. I remember reading this book by Karas about the word spinster. And apparently the word spinster was kind of synonymous with prostitute because, you know, when you've done the shearing and there's no more carding or whatever it is you're doing to be done, then you'll do sex work until, you know, the cycle comes back round again. And this is a massive leap, but I'm going to make it. So we're going to go from sheep, right, to I love what I really love about your book. Okay, now the book's very visual. I love some of the pictures you've got around it. But what really strikes me as being kind of very different to the way that we view bodies at the moment is the hairiness. The hairiness.
So much hair.
I know the hairiness of the Victorian female is noteworthy.
Isn't it?
And I wondered when that stopped being attractive, when porn and sort of other sort of sexual literature stopped featuring sort of genital hair. Yeah.
Well, I mean, so I tweet a lot of pictures of vintage erotica, and there's certainly a lot in the book. And as you rightly point out, do you know what? That's the thing that people comment most of all on Twitter was when they see the images, because we live in such an image-saturated society, but our view of what is erotic and sexual is really tightly constrained. It's really stylized. We know what we expect. If you're watching porn or something erotic, even if you're just taking a selfie, we all know, you know, you do the duck pout and you've got your makeup and all that stuff. But when photography was first invented, none of that existed. So people are very much trying to work out what's sexy. And what you've got is very normal but beautiful bodies. They're not chiseled. They don't have six packs. They don't have breast implants or liposuction or tattoos. And they've got a lot of hair. They've just got the natural hair because the style has not yet emerged where that looks weird.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to know is how strange it looks to modernize, because how used we are now to seeing bodies with no hair, with no pubic hair whatsoever. That if you do see it, it looks like, oh my God, look, there's pubic hair there. And it hasn't always been that way, you know. In fact, in the Renaissance, there's a lot of body literature that really celebrates pubic hair in women. And it's regarded as like a sign of health and fertility, in the same way that if a cat walked in and it was all kind of bald and mangy and didn't have any fur, you'd be like, oh my God, what's wrong with it? That is very much how they viewed pubic hair. But if a cat comes in, it's got, you know, full, thick, luscious fur, you're like, that's a nice cat. That was how they viewed it. So this, you get this, Rochester, the Earl of Rochester wrote really bawdy poetry in the 17th century. He at one point says that his prick will no more to bold cunt resort. He says it sounds like rustling leather, which is a hell of an image.
Wow.
Yeah.
And given the lack of depilation at the time, it makes you wonder where it'd been going.
Yeah. Right? Actually, I think that what it was as well is something that would make your hair fall out, syphilis.
Oh.
Right? So advanced stages of syphilis would make pubic hair fall out. But what would definitely make your hair fall out was what they used to treat syphilis, mercury.
Okay.
So, I mean, it didn't do you any fucking good at all. But one of the things it did do is it made your hair fall out. So not having pubes, that was a bit of a giveaway that you had syphilis.
Didn't Rochester have syphilis?
Oh, yes, he did. And if you think of like an STD, he had it. He was like a venereal disease pinata. He was just absolutely riddled with it. He died really young of complications from syphilis.
Wow.
He was 36, I think, and he had gonorrhea and he had a whole host of everything. Yeah.
I particularly liked your chapter about sex work in what was that phrase you used? I can't remember it. Colonial sex work.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, because we tend to think, when we think of a sort of sex work outside of the sort of Northwest, the global Northwest, we automatically start to hear these debates around trafficking and stuff like that. Yeah, you know, sort of poor brown people being bought to be exploited by, you know, in the global Northwest. And I wanted to hear what you'd found, you know, what you'd found when researching that chapter.
Yes. So again, attitudes vastly different. And one of the many lovely things that the Westerners did when we went round the world going, well, we're in charge now, is we brought with it all of our own attitudes around sexual morality. And we didn't really bother to find out or appreciate what anyone else's attitudes were. So when the British took over India, they could not comprehend sexual labor or a system of, I suppose they were called notch girls or devadasi, who were girls that were dedicated to the goddess Yelima, and they would raise money for the temples through sex. Well, the British were absolutely revolted by this, and they set about abolishing the Devadasi and the Notch Girls, and creating shame around it. And they succeeded, although the practice still goes on, but it's shunned and stigmatized now and quite dangerous now. But the Devadasi were, you know, like they were the Kardashians of their day, man, except more useful. They, you know, they were pioneers of art and literature and poetry, and they were lovers to kings and maharajas, and they collected art and they educated. There were some super powerful women, and they had I suppose patrons, really powerful patrons who would pay so much money to have sex with these women. But the sex was kind of incidental, you know, that it was just part of their world. But the British colonizers couldn't comprehend that at all. So they set around creating shame. They set around outlawing it. And then suddenly it becomes a very dangerous practice. It becomes shamed and stigmatized and shunned. And the Devadasi suddenly, they're forced to earn their living selling sex on the streets or for dancing or coins. And it changes it completely. And we've managed to do that successfully all around the world. Done it everywhere, because we can't understand that sex is not shameful, especially female sexuality.
Yeah, I read something really interesting about the history of the East India Company. Mm. And the East India Company, you know, was very concerned that a lot of its the people that were working for it, its employees and its soldiers, because it was basically an occupying force, were having relationships with Indian women and producing like mixed race children, that they did not want to be able to take part sort of politically within the framework of the East India Company. Yeah. So they started a really systematic like attack on Indian women. So women that were engaged in activities that weren't considered to be prostitution, yeah, might be considered on the outskirts of sex work, became labelled as prostitutes. And then the next thing you know, they're kind of herded into these places called Lal Bazaars, which is like become like red light districts. And then right in the middle of that, you've got these lock hospitals where women are examined for contagious diseases like syphilis. That falls out of favour in India and then reappears again in England 30 years later as a way of controlling sex workers in the newly developed industrial cities. And it's really interesting to see how there's a kind of attack on women who may be outside or distracting from the patriarchal systematic way of making money are attacked. You know, and how, you know, that seems to roll around the globe, depending on where people are at in their industrial, you know, where countries are at in their industrial revolutions or their capitalist developments. You know, I think it's really interesting. So at the moment, you know, my own study is webcamming, and we have a lot of debate around trafficking and physical sex work, but no discussion at all about webcamming, which is entirely legal and where everyone's hooking up online anyway.
It's so funny the way, like, we're in such a state of cognitive dissonance around sex work. It's like how people manage to put bits of it in boxes and then just deny other bits of it and pretend. And it's like the same way that people will go, that's absolute, I would never do that. What an absolute terrible thing to do. And then they'll go home and wank off over porn.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's really strange that people will have these ideas that oh, it's all terrible, but won't look at their own behavior and what they do within that context at all. And we've done that all throughout history. Like the Contagious Diseases Act that you mentioned there, that was a really crap effort to try and control venereal disease in the troops, but they didn't apply that to the troops themselves. It was only to the women. So how the hell is that going to work? You know, it's not going to do anything, is it? But no. It's that was enforced for years in Britain, about 20 years that they were doing this in certain towns. It was perfectly legal to just drag any woman that you suspected of selling sex off the streets and force her to submit to a vaginal examination.
Nuts. I liked as well, and I think this was really important, because the imagery of sex work always really bothers me. And I know we've got colleagues that are kind of really interested in that. But what I like a lot about your book is that we have groups of people together, not engaged necessarily in like orgies or anything like that, but who are together Yeah, so I like these pictures of Victorian women with their friends. Yeah, I like, you know, that image where we're removed from that image that we see nowadays of like a lone pair of female legs that seem to represent all sex workers, to actually people being together. And what I really noticed was your chapter about male sex work.
Yes.
And the way that they were so openly looking at the camera was kind of almost like engaged in a sexual act, but without actually acknowledging. So they're looking at the camera rather than each other's genitals.
Yes. Yeah,
they're engaging with the camera person. So you get the impression of like sort of a more sociable activity.
It's so true. That's one of the things that I love most about Victorian pornography. And it's one of the things that is markedly different from modern pornography, and I think it's because they're still working out the technology. They're working out what looks sexy, and you can really tell it in some of the early images. There's kind of like if I do this, how about that? Does this look sexy? Some of them have got taxidermy in it. Like this one has got a stuffed dog in it. I just love to have heard the conversation. But I think it needs a dog. Does it need a dog? Does that work? But one of the things that I really like about it is the people are like, they're having loads of fun.
Yeah,
it's like that. They're laughing and they're smiling, and they look like they care. I might be creating narratives around it and I've got no right to, but in modern pornography, it's like, you know, like show that you're caught in these absolute ecstasies of wild desire, that, you know, that it's like, oh my, like eyes roll back in your head and it's absolutely crazy, which is great sex. But it's, you know, the Victorian pornography, it's like they're laughing and they're having fun, and it's a different setup completely. And I love that about it.
Yeah, you get the sense that they were kind of getting sort of turned on as they were recording.
Yes.
Because I heard, I think it was a TED talk one time, and this guy was talking about, you don't see hands in pornography.
That's so true.
You don't see hands in pornography. And you in your book, like people are touching each other and they're kind of like exploring each other.
Yes.
You know, especially the women, it's almost that they're exploring each other, and it's so unindustrial.
Unindustrial, that's the perfect word for it. Is it? It looks playful, and they look like they're aroused and having fun. They really do, which is like, you know, when you look at modern pornography, you'd think that, well, you know, that's all geared to like, right, absolute hardcore. We are. This is so sexy. This is. But the Victorian stuff actually looks like real people, really having sex.
Yeah,
which I guess is what it was. You know, and I love that about it. It's I think it's very erotic, but it's also very revealing about how what we regard as an erotic image has changed and shifted.
I wonder as well if there's a connection between a sort of like more mass production of pornographic images and less hair being visible.
I think you're probably right. I think that pubic hair and its disappearance has got to be linked to, in part at least, to the availability of images. Because one of the reasons there's so much pubic hair in Victorian erotica is because, you know, no one's told them not to have it. We're currently in a cycle at the moment because all the porn, unless you look for specialist stuff, everyone's cuboled. Like, nobody has pubic hair. So then that becomes the normal. Who's going to break that? And because most of the images that we see around sex come from porn, as we are growing up and developing, that becomes normal.
Yeah.
So that, and it's really hard to shift that. If the only images that you're seeing are, you know, there's absolutely no pubes there, there's no labia, or it's been trimmed back, or, you know, like it's been vajazzled and buffed and shined and all the rest of it, that's the normal. But it's not normal, is it? It's just, it's a very strange thing that when, I think it's because of the images. It's because that creates a reality that you see, you know? You see more images in porn than you see in real life when it comes to genitals. I mean, like, you know, you don't sit around with your mates and as you're growing up, but well, maybe you do, and sort of show each other's, but you probably, your most exposure is going to be in porn as you're developing, I suppose.
Yeah, it's going to be your formative stuff, isn't it?
That's the word I'm looking for, formative stuff. Yes.
But I have to ask about the monkey testicles.
Yes.
Tell us about the monkey testicles.
So I think it might be my favorite chapter, that one. I love that. So It's just bonkers, right? In the early 20th century, science was just starting to get to grips with hormones, therapies. Hormones have been discovered. We know what they do. They do stuff. And there was a lot of kind of excitement around, like, oh my God, what can we do with it? And one theory that, that came up was that men lose their hair, or as they're aging, or they might, you know, lose their erections as they're growing up because the testosterone levels drop. So the idea suddenly comes in, we can give them more testosterone, then we'll fix everything. But the theory was that came out was that if you grafted an implant from a chimp's testicle into a human male subject, into his testicle, that this would somehow rejuvenate his own hormone levels. And the guy who kind of pioneered this was called Voronov. He was a Russian-born surgeon, and he became hugely famous for this. And he had so many testimonials that swore down that it was the most amazing thing ever. And he was really riding high on this for about 10 years before people started trying to replicate his results and didn't get anything at all. That he kind of fell out of favor and he became a quack, regarded as a quack. But this was like really, this was such big business, right? And it was so huge that in the 1920s in Chicago, this is quite disturbing, but there was a number of cases of young men waking up in an alleyway with no memory of what had happened the night before. And they were very, very sore in the groin area. And when they went to hospital, it turned out that they had had their scrotal sac removed and then stitched back up. And no one was ever caught for it. There were three cases of this happening. And the theory is that somebody was paying to have their testicles so they could be grafted into the body of someone presumably very rich and powerful who could do this. But it was, yeah, it was reported in the press as gland larceny.
No.
Swear down. Yep. All have a look, look at it up. And if you couldn't afford to have a monkey or some poor bugger testicles grafted into your own, there was a big vogue for gland cream, like face creams and lotions and potions that supposedly had glands, quote unquote, testicles in them.
Wow. What, human testicles or animal testicles?
I'm going to say animal testicles, although I don't have any around to test. I don't know how much testicles are in these creams, but they were certainly being sold as like, you know, elixirs of youth.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So, bearing in mind sort of like the halls of your thing, and that this podcast will, you know, sort of will be the first of many where we do discuss sex, but sex work as well. Who's your favorite whore of yore?
Oh, wow. Oh.
Obviously, Clarissa must be up there.
Absolutely. Maybe Nell Gwynn. I think that she was like, she started life. Apparently, she was born in a brothel, 17th century, and she kind of shagged away right to the top, became the mistress of Charles II, and was hugely, hugely powerful in her own right. And she was also really funny. There's lots of cases of just how witty she is, and like a really acerbic wit. She seems like a lot of fun. So I think she's probably one of my favorites. One that I'm looking at the moment is an artist called Pan Yuliang, who was Chinese, and she was sold to a brothel by her uncle when she was 14, and she had her freedom bought by the man who had become her husband at 18. She started studying art and painting these amazing nudes, and she started traveling around the world, but then things, attitudes started changing in China in the 1930s, and her past as a sex worker was used very much against her in the fact she was painting nudes. She had to flee China and never went back, but lived out the rest of her life eking out a living in France, teaching art. But her work is just absolutely, it's so beautiful. She's using herself as a model a lot, but her exploration of the female body, and she's got to be one of my favorites. She's incredible.
Yeah. I've always been really fascinated by Theodora, you know, the Empress Theodora. Because she's born in a brothel, and she's kind of like, literally, she's like the empress of the known world. You know, sort of at the time when the Christianity was starting to be sort of shaped, you know, she's very much used to kind of start to sort of create the image of the Virgin Mary. You know, this is where we find sort of Theodora being sort of like, sort of almost what's the word, mainstream.
Theodora was a bad bitch. She was just incredible. She was so powerful. She was known by like her enemies who were dismissed as Theodora from the brothel. It was like a kind of But she was married to the emperor, a hugely powerful woman, and she passed protective rules for women and
Around for procuring. Sex. Yeah, yes. Around procuring and pimping.
She did. She did. So she's absolutely incredible. Oh. So yeah, she'd definitely have to be up there, one of my favourites.
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting as well, that discussion, like, and it's quite odd that somebody, we've been talking now for 3/4 of an hour and we've only just started to talk about procuring or pimping. Yeah.
Yes.
Because that is like people's most, you know, that's the general conversation starts off with trafficking,
yep,
and abuse. But I sort of like, I was really interested in what you'd found out about the relationships, the personal relationships that sex workers have outside of sex work.
Yes. I mean, that's, again, that's the stereotype, isn't it? Is and that is a part of sex work, pimping, procuring, trafficking. They all exist within it. You can't pretend that it doesn't, but it's one part of a much wider puzzle. And I think that one of the things that we have this idea is that a sex worker is, that they would never be able to assume some kind of quote unquote normal relationship or normal life, which just isn't the case at all.
Right.
Of course it's not. It is work. Go home, you know, you've done your day's work and you have a family, and that's been true throughout history. Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't think I've asked you this, but what is it that you found out that was most interesting to you, that really kind of resonated with you? What really kind of about researching this book really opened up something that you were totally not expecting to find?
I suppose if you look at, like, all throughout history or as much of it as possible, you start to see that attitudes to sex work are very circular. We keep doing the same shit and it doesn't work. Mm. It's in this cycle constantly of repression, uneasy tolerance, and then repression starts to come in again, then criminalization, then suppression, and then that doesn't work, and then we're back to kind of uneasy tolerance. There have been so many laws passed throughout history to attempt to abolish or control or zone or all these things, and they always result, they don't work.
Nice.
And it's, you know, kind of looking at it like in a very long history, is you end up just going, why do we keep doing this? It's never worked. You know, like, the one thing that people don't try or haven't until this century and last century is decriminalization and just letting people get on with it.
Yeah. So because like, obviously anything to do with sex workers, like, for the reasons that you've just described, it's like heavily politicized,
mm,
and sort of like really attracts binaries of exploitation or liberation and tends to attract a lot of attention. What was the feedback that you got from writing this book?
It's been mostly good. I think people say nice things. People say that it made them laugh. It made them think. Because I write about sex, and because I write about sex work, and because I don't fight for the abolition or suppression of sex work, is that invites haters. You know, of course it does. I'm sure that they hate it, but they haven't said anything directly to me just yet. So at the moment, the result has been positive. But when you write about sex and sex work, as you know, is you're always going to piss someone off. Always.
Yeah. But you're a lecturer at the University,
yes,
of Leeds, yeah?
Leeds Trinity.
How do your students react to your book?
They love it. We have a great time. The university have just let me start teaching a module called Sexuality Studies, which, okay, after a long time of wrangling and being like, no, come on, let me teach something. And we've done it, and sex work is a big part of that, looking at it. And it's brilliant. And they've, loads of students signed up to it, and they're really engaged, and it's what they want to talk about, and it's what they want to research. So the students have been absolutely amazing. They're lovely. They're hugely enthusiastic, and they think it's really funny.
Well, the thing is, the more we can talk about sex work,
right,
the more we can talk about the different varieties of sex work, you know. Sort of,
absolutely.
Like, you know, it's only very recently that we've started to engage in a conversation around trans sex workers. But,
yes,
they've always been part of the sex working community, but it's almost like it's only recently that we've been able to even have that discussion.
Yes.
You know, I wondered at the moment, what other books you're reading, you know, sort of sex work related books you're reading?
I've just finished writing actually a book on the history of sex work for Thames and Hudson. So I have been reading so much, and the thing that I've been reading recently is about sex work in the First and Second World Wars. That's what I've been reading about, and about how different nations and different fighting nations and what their approach to attempting to control sex work was.
So that's
been really interesting. And Julia Late, she wrote, I can't remember the exact title, but she wrote a fantastic book about sex work from the late Victorian to the Second World War, and that's been really useful. She's an amazing scholar.
I've read that book as well. I want to say Common Women.
Is it that? That sounds right, actually.
I want to say Common Women, but that's a really good book because, you know, I'd like to sort of, you know, we're coming to the end of the interview now. So I just wanted to, you know, like some recommendations of books that maybe we could feature later on in the series. You know, so Julia Late, definitely. And
obviously Revolting Prostitutes by Juno Mack and Molly. Yeah, absolutely. That's phenomenal.
I've reached out to them, but they're not doing any public publicity.
Fair enough.
The amount of flack that they got writing as active sex workers.
Awful.
You know, it's really awful. They really got some sort of like some really negative feedback. This has been amazing. So anyway, so just to, you know, if you can give the listeners the details of the book that we've just been discussing for the last hour.
Oh, I would love to. So it's A Curious History of Sex. And it's by me, Kate Lister, and it's published by Unbound, and it's available in all the places you'd get books from. Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Kate. That has been amazing. Thank you for starting this series with a really interesting hands-on look at sex.